everybody, it's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here, and I cannot tell you how happy I am to be able to have this opportunity to talk to thousands of citizens in 15 countries on all the continents in the world who have come together today to protest this coup d'etat by big data, by big telecom, by big tech, by the big oil and chemical companies, and by this global public health cartel led by Bill Gates and the WHO that now amounts to $2 trillion and wants to magnify and amplify its wealth and its power over our lives, over our liberties, that wants to subvert our democracies, that want to destroy our sovereignty and our control over our lives and our children's health. And I want to remind you, those of you who are not Americans, of something that every American child learns when we're growing up in this country about our history. During the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt, who was one of the greatest presidents in American history, said to the American people, "The only thing that we have to fear is fear itself." You are on the front lines of the most important battle in history. And it is the battle to save democracy and freedom and human liberty and human dignity from this totalitarian cartel that is trying to rob us simultaneously in every nation in the world of the rights that every human being is born with. So thank you for your courage. Thank you for your commitment. And thank you for your brotherhood, and I can pledge to you that I will go down dying with my boots on, fighting side by side with all of you to make sure that we return these rights and preserve them for our children. And I will see all of you on the barricades. Thank you.
So we are coming to the concluding session of this conference, in the course of which we have heard from medical specialists, we have heard from economists and politicians, and we have heard from clinical doctors, and we have been able to build a compelling and comprehensive view of this pandemic. Now, in this concluding section, I would like to come to the other byline of our conference, a call for intervention. Okay, so I would like to first briefly introduce the guests who have already been introduced all individually in previous sections, but just as a reminder, Catherine Austin Fitz is the editor, the founder and editor of the Solari Report. Sucharit Bhakti is a professor of medical microbiology and immunology. Thomas Binder is a cardiologist from Switzerland, and Rainer Füllmich is a lawyer who works in Germany and in the United States of America. Thank you all for joining. Catherine, I would like to start with you. What would be your most important takeaway from this conference, and also what would be your most important advice to people who may have followed us and who may be wondering now, how can they protect themselves? How can they protect their children? Catherine, please.
So knowledge is power, and I think those listening to this have heard a great deal of knowledge, and the question is, how do they translate that into an action to protect their children at school, to protect themselves as an employee whose employer may be mandating this, to protect themselves or protect family members who are considering the vaccination, but they want to educate them? And if you go to the Doctors for COVID Ethics website on the resources page, you will see access to four forms. A form for employees to help them educate their employers and hold them to a true informed consent, as Vera was talking about in the last panel. A form to do likewise for parents and students who are trying to protect themselves, particularly from the mandates at schools. There is also a parental consent form. If you're concerned that your jurisdiction will accept a consent from a child, and you want to make sure they can't and won't. There's a parental consent form, and finally, there's a family disclosure form to work through with your spouse or someone else in your family who's considering taking this and doesn't realize what it could do to their health. And I would encourage you to use those. The idea is to take the powerful knowledge that you've heard over the last 2 days and translate it into a practical tool that you can use. And my feedback so far, our feedback is from parents, from spouses, from employees and students on the ground. They are backing the process up because what you need is a practical tool to help you educate. This is highly complicated information. I don't know about you. I got a C in biology. I'm probably the only one on this panel who didn't get a good grade in biology. So the goal is to put you out in the field. You're the army, and we need to fight this war in the trenches with the knowledge. There are a lot of additional resources at the Doctor for COVID Ethics, but I'll pass the ball now, and I'd like to come back and talk about some more of the tools there.
Thank you, Catherine. Thomas, we haven't heard from you in a while. And I think the perspective of clinical physicians is particularly important, and you have long been part of this fight. You have thought about these things very carefully. So I would like to have you give us your perspective. What is your advice? What are your demands that what we should do? Thank you.
Well, during 2 days, we heard many real experts in their fields. My current state of ignorance as a curious ordinary doctor is simply put this. An endemic of a seasonal beta corona cold virus that may kill some people, of course, that is becoming more and more harmless through permanent mutation, has been inflated into a pandemic of a perennial killer virus that is becoming increasingly dangerous through erratic mutations, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and so on and so forth, with PR, PCR, masks, and the myths of epidemiologically relevant asymptomatic transmission, and fought with serial, unnecessary, ineffective, unsafe experimental mRNA and DNA injections. This tape form sentence shorter. I tweeted this in March 2020. Mainly the test causes the disease, not the virus, or even shorter, the test is the pest. But not only the test is the pest, of course, the entire prevailing corona narrative is nonsense. It justifies the globally dominating unscientific inhumane madness such as such can be wrought with any respiratory virus, by the way. If you no longer test all people with a hypersensitive, flow-specific RT-PCR test that cross-reacts with other viruses for theoretically one single RNA fragment of SARS-CoV-2, but for one of, say, influenza or metapneumoviruses, we immediately have an influenza or metapneumovirus testing pandemic. Currently, the pest, in proper English, the plague, is morphing from unscientific, unmedical mass testing into applying inhumane experimental mass injections. These injections, first and foremost for children, are utterly pointless, as we heard by many experts of the field, and for many healthy people, both acutely and chronically disabling and life-threatening. So I really want all fellow doctors to realize that it is our duty and responsibility to follow the Hippocratic Oath. Primum non nocere refers to no harm, and the Geneva Declaration of the World Medical Association, especially, I will not use my medical knowledge to violate human rights and civil liberties, even under threat. And during these times of universal deceit, nobody may trust in anybody. We doctors must no longer put unconditional trust in scientists, medical associations, health authorities, or even in the once most respected medical journals. And first and foremost, we must not trust in ourselves, because more dangerous than ignorance is to believe that we know something beyond any doubt. We must acquire all the information that is important for the health of our patients and of the whole society, and we must verify it ourselves. We all let ourselves become deluded, some less long, others for longer time. No one needs to apologize for this, but we can no longer apologize after, once informed, we still are useful frontline idiots in this global crime against humanity. Because if we doctors stop participating first and foremost by no longer applying unnecessary, ineffective, unsafe experimental mRNA and DNA injections, the corona nonsense house of cards will immediately collapse. So please, dear fellow doctors, wake up, stand up and act accordingly now.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for those powerful words, Thomas. So we have heard what the doctors should do from Thomas. Maybe I can ask Rainer what he thinks the lawyers could do at a time when most of the courts of law seem to be closed for business. Rainer, can you unmute?
They're not all closed for business. Here in Germany, it's particularly bad, but there are other countries where the legal systems are still working. India is one of these countries. And in India, even the Supreme Court is still functioning. Now, this is one of the countries that the other side probably didn't really have on the radar. Neither did they have South Africa on the radar. So on the backdrop of all this is the facts are the same everywhere. The facts are the same everywhere. So any decision that we get from any of the courts of law with respect to the PCR test, with respect to mask mandates, et cetera, they always apply in all other jurisdictions as well. The fact finding is applicable in all jurisdictions. So we shouldn't give up on the legal front. We have to continue with this. But as I said earlier, it is a combination of going to the courts of law, educating people, getting everything out into the open, exposing all these, well, monstrous schemes. And of course, then there's the spiritual side in addition, which is probably going to be crucial. As I said earlier, I wouldn't have taken this seriously at all a year and a half ago, but times have changed. So I think that's where the real action is. Only today, and I was going to say this is probably a coincidence, but I don't believe in coincidences anymore. Today, I just returned from Berlin from our Friday's session of the Corona Committee, and we interviewed Dr. Brian Artist from Texas. And this was so incredible to hear what he had to tell us. This is brand new, at least it was to me. I mean, I've seen videos with him, but our viewers were really shocked. You can see it from what's going on in the chat. He told us how Fauci mandated remdesivir in the entire country. And he also told us that he tried to check up on this. Why did Fauci mandate this? It's based on two studies. And these two studies say that remdesivir is extremely dangerous. It's probably responsible for 85% of the deaths that occurred in New York, where they had real spikes. He also said that the CDC in October, 2 months before the so-called vaccination started, knew everything about the adverse effects, everything, including sterilization, including the deaths, including, I think, 105 different types of autoimmune problems. It's just mind-boggling. And this leaves only one conclusion to draw from a legal standpoint. This is intentional, or even malicious, as my friend Professor Schwab says, malicious infliction of harm. There is no immunity from intentional infliction of harm for no one. So that is, and then the big question is, why has it come to this? Why? Because you're right, Catherine, of course, knowledge is power. But there's so many people out there who could be, who could look at the evidence that we have, but they don't. Or maybe they do, but it doesn't sink in. Why is this happening? Well, we had another expert, Professor Desmet from Brussels, and he tells us this is about mass psychology. It's about mass hypnosis, and it's a real kind of hypnosis. It's like the type of hypnosis that some doctors use when they perform surgery even. So people who are under this hypnosis do not, they don't feel anything. They don't, it's not their fault, but that's how it is. He says only about 30% of the population really fall victim to this. And then there's another 40% or so who are kind of in between. And then there's 20 to 30% of the population who understand what's going on. And that's us. And it's our tasks. It's up to us to keep educating the people, to bring out the truth, to expose everything, because that's going to help turn the tide, both with the general population, but also, of course, with the courts of law.
Thank you very much, Rainer. I think we will get back to the legal question later on, for example, regarding notices of liability. I would be interested to hear about those experiences from your side. But for now, I would actually like to go on to Patrick Henningsen, who has joined us, independent journalist, who has already been on several sessions today here, so I'm not going to make many words of introduction. But maybe Patrick can offer us his insights on the final thoughts of Rainer.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you to everybody who's contributed. It's been a very educational. I might point specifically to the testimonies from the MDs, from the general practitioners, and the doctors yesterday, and that really brings things close to home. One of the biggest crimes in all of this, and one thing that we're going to be facing, looking down the barrel of a loaded gun this coming fall and winter, is the complete throttling and really the dismantling effectively of the healthcare system in many countries under the guise of preparing for COVID or preparing for a pandemic. Certainly the national health system, the NHS, which the government rallied everybody to protect 3 weeks to flatten the curve last March, is not providing care ostensibly. A lot of telephone appointments, a lot of people are, the queue is growing. It was at 4.5 million last summer. We're told by the new health secretary that could reach 10 million backlog for appointments. As you know, this will never, this type of backlog will never be resolved. It'll just keep going on and rolling on year after year. So you have effectively no functioning healthcare system in a number of countries, not anything near what they're used to. So again, this is going to have a compounding effect as we go forward year-round continuously. Now, there's people who are saying this is preparing it for privatization, preparing it the lamb to the slaughter, so to speak. That will be determined in the future whether that's the case or not. It certainly looks like it. There is a demand now for private healthcare in countries that normally had national healthcare. So that's something to look at in terms of the opportunism. But in terms of the media, I think none of this would have been possible without the press and the media. The press and the media are doing the gaslighting on a mass scale. Journalists, editors, TV pundits, they become glorified sales reps for the pharmaceutical industry. That's effectively the role they're playing. And this is a problem that started decades ago. If you read John Abramson's great book, The Overdosing of America, you can see how the drugs companies have gradually captured the general practitioners and medical practices over the years to the point where it's becoming very difficult, especially in a country like the United States, to get care if you're a doctor, give care if you're a doctor, because your patients are demanding drugs that they've seen advertised on TV. And what we've seen in the last year or so with the vaccines and these pharmaceutical companies that have billions of dollars of judgments against them in terms of damages, all of a sudden are bestowed saint-like status by government officials, like these are somehow omnipotent corporations that could do no harm. And in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. So we are in a very perilous situation in regards to regulatory capture and media capture. And so this is a really difficult impasse that we find ourselves when you have media, government, and the pharmaceutical industry locked in so tight. And so we really rely on the public's level of education, as Reiner mentioned. That's a high priority. That's certainly what a lot of people on this panel have done so amazingly in recent months, have educated millions of people with their presentations. So we want to thank everybody for that and to keep going with that.
Great. Thank you very much, Patrick. So, Jared, you have put together this conference and you have been a scientist all your life. So you have come out very strongly, very clearly, very early with your position on this pandemic. So what can we do? May I ask you, what can we do to get science back on track? Because it appears that science, to a very large extent, has been hijacked, as have almost all other sectors of society. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Michael, first of all, let me say that this symposium, well, we had hitches yesterday, but all in all, it's been profoundly impressive to me to see so many wonderfully, what is it called? You're wonderfully human people. The best that, you know, humanity produces come together. None of us has known each other before this event, except perhaps you and me. But we've all been strangers to each other, but now we are united. We're friends because we know that only by coming together, we have a chance, small, small chance. Make no mistake, the chance is not that big, Reiner. To overcome what otherwise is going to be the apocalypse. This is absolutely clear that if this satanic agenda cannot be stopped, as has been said repeatedly today by different people, humanity will end as it is. Now, the problem is, Michael, the problem that you asked me is, how can you get science back online? And my answer is, we're not going to. I read this brilliant book by Bruce Charlton, who 8 years ago wrote down in clearest words why science no longer existed, 2013. Now, 8 years later, I read his words and say, every word was right. And he said, science exists no more, because what has happened is that in the 60s and 70s, we had, you know, the specialization. So we had medicine, and then we had infectious diseases, immunology, etc., etc., virology, bacteriology, internal medicine, surgery, and things got more and more specialized. So each of the specialized group started to lose hold of the whole picture. And medicine and medical science started to stop to exist in the mid-80s. And so there was ever more specialization. No, virology came up as a specialized part of microbiology in the 80s. When I went to Mainz to chair this department, virology was still part of the department that I chaired. But it was I who said virology should be moved out, be a separate unit, because they've become so important that they need to have their own budget, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what happened worldwide. So that was okay, and we remained friends. However, then the specialization went on and on and on, and as Bruce Chatton said, more and more people knew less and less of everything. And more of only their very specialized area. But they became unlinked. So people in the virology department did not know anything about immunology. And the immunologists knew nothing about bacteria or bacterial toxins. And so everything became sort of units of experts. And each unit would be responsible for itself. And this was the beginning of peer review that led to the end of science, because the virologists would review each other, and those that the majority believed in was the correct thing, was the narrative. And if you did not go in with them, you wouldn't get your science grants, you can't do your own research, etc. And that happened to every field, so that you had this so-called peer review, which was nothing else than the guys who had the say, saying what could be researched and what should not be researched. And you know, I was always one of those guys who weren't doing the things that I was not supposed to do, and I had great problems getting my grants through, and that worked up to the very end, fortunately. But at the very end, I was doing malaria research, you know, and it was not bad at all. But I didn't get my grant through. It was just, just rejected, grant rejected. You know, so that's what's happening. And therefore, you cannot revive science. However, and now I come to Thomas, because what he said was so good. Thomas, you should be saying this as the closing words. The only people who can stop this madness are the doctors, the physicians. And it is our damn duty, right, Michael? Right, Thomas? It's our damn duty. And let those other guys go to wherever they want and do whatever they want. Because the fact that politicians are greedy for money and power is just normal. I don't mind. I mean, we have to realize that, you know, the Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist, say, you know, the one important thing in life is to rejoice with others when they're successful. And I have no problem at all rejoicing for the politicians if they are successful, rejoicing for the pharmaceutical industry if they have done something good and are earning money. Why shouldn't they? This is what they're there for. But what I do object to is that when the boundaries of ethics are trespassed, as they are right now, then there's no pardon. There's no pardon for the politicians. There's no pardon for the pharmaceutical industry. There's no pardon for the bankers. But first and foremost, there is no pardon for the physicians, because they are forgotten about the ethics of medicine. And Thomas said this so beautifully that I think I will stop now.
Okay, thank you. Now, the physicians are also under a lot of pressure, right, which we should not forget. So I think that very many physicians will only very reluctantly comply with all of this. Okay.
Excuse me. All the physicians have to do is say, I will not give you this death.
I agree. You're right. Now, you have named the problems that afflict science, and I think that's the first step about threat in the direction of solving those problems. I will only venture to say I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are, but okay, I think maybe for another day. Good. Okay. Thomas, do you have thoughts on Sucharit's statement?
Well, I fully agree with Sucharit, like always. We had actually the same teacher once. was a Swiss professor, Walter Sigrist. He first was Sucharit's teacher in Bonn. Later, he was my teacher in Switzerland. Zhu Shaorit often explained it nicely, what he taught us, that we must stick to ethics, and we must always question ourselves and question what we are doing. Are we working in the best interest of our patients, or are we working in the interest of other people, or are we working in the interest of ourselves? And in February 2020, I was sitting in my practice, and I wondered what the heck is going on. Everything I had learned during my studies, during my scientific education, during my practical medical life, was turned topsy-turvy. Mm-hmm. To become insane is actually very difficult for a doctor in this time. I mean, I have to do evidence-based medicine as a cardiologist in this totally unscientific, medical, unethical world. I sometimes ask whether as a cardiologist I should not thoroughly question and then examine the patients, but just roll two dice. On the one dice is the diagnosis, and the other dice is for the severity of the diagnosis. I mean, this is the current level of what is happening in science, in the corona science, actually. I mean, it's really usually I'm speechless, and it's difficult to find the words. And I still do not understand why my fellow doctors, even if they had no idea about PCR and all this, and even if they trusted in everybody, in every medical journal, in every authority, why they did not realize that it was just the wrong indication to test. I mean, this is the fundamental myth of this corona narrative, that we do no longer test severely sick, hospitalized patients who need specific antiviral therapy, but even where we must know the infectious agent to treat them appropriately, but also less sick patients and even asymptomatic, formerly called healthy people. And this is utter nonsense. And above all, not to test generally, but to test only for one of all possible infectious agents. I mean, this is exactly Walter Sigrist, our teacher, Zhu Shaorit. He was the master of differential diagnosis. And this is exactly what he had learned us. In any case, there is a differential diagnosis, and differential diagnosis was completely lost. If, for example, you have a billion influenza viruses in your throat and you're looking for SARS-CoV-2, that you maybe have 100 in your throat, you will find these 100 SARS-CoV-2 and mislabel influenza as SARS-CoV-2. Yeah, Zhu Shaorit, you're raising your hand.
Yeah, Zhu Shaorit.
Yes, Thomas, precisely. That's exactly what he said. I want to complement that with other things that Walter Siegenthaler also taught us. By the way, not only he, but my mother. My mother was also a physician, and she was the first doctor whom I followed as a child to look at patients, because I was interested to see, you know, how things were. Both of them. My mother and Walter Siegenthaler said, the first thing you look at when someone is ill is the patient, not a scrap of paper. All right, you may want to see whether your presumptive diagnosis is correct by doing a lab test, but the lab test can never, ever replace the human patient. And what is happening today, Thomas, is so shocking and so, yeah, I'm speechless. How can our colleagues not look at patients anymore? You know, Walter Siegenthaler would say, you have failed. You get out of this room and come back in half a year, because in our times, you know, we didn't have this crossing things. We had to come and Walter Siegenthaler would sit there, you know, the four of us around his table, and he would ask us. And there were always questions that were extremely important. If you couldn't answer those questions, they were called the death questions. If you couldn't answer the death questions that Walter Siegenthaler was going to ask you, you better not go, okay? You can know all the other details. But if you don't know that, Herr Bhakti, we spoke to him, yeah? If a young person comes in and has a splitting headache and is feeling so bad and starts to vomit, and he's never done this before, he was him. What is the first thing you're going to think of? And if you don't say, this could be a cerebral venous thrombosis, you're out. You're out. What's happening now? Thousands of people are going to the doctor saying, oh, after that drug, I've had this splitting headache. I can't see properly. I can't speak properly. I am feeling horrible. Go home. It has nothing to do with the vaccine. You know, all our colleagues who are doing this should be taken to court. Should be taken to court. Because everyone knows that if you okay. have a cerebral venous thrombosis that is not diagnosed and treated.
Maybe I can cut in here, because you brought up the keyword court. We have a question from the audience directed at Rainer Füllmich, presumably. The question is, what can we do to accelerate court proceedings? How can we make the courts actually do their business and not just simply sit on all those filed lawsuits and not do a thing? Is there any hopeful answer to that, Rainer?
Well, in reality, there's not much you can do. You cannot pressure a court into becoming active. What you can do in order to get a quick decision and hoping that it's going to be one in your favor is to move for a temporary restraining order. That's what our colleague Tom Renz just did when he found out through a whistleblower that the numbers of deaths after vaccinations were not the numbers that were given to us by the media were not the true numbers. And this is only one system. So we're now talking about probably at least 500,000 people who died after getting the shots in the U.S. alone. It's probably more than that. We spoke to Dr. Zelenko. We spoke to Dr. Artis today, and they're all in agreement as far as that's concerned. So that should push the courts of law to act faster. However, there is a, I think this is a universal truth anywhere in the world when it comes to the judiciaries. The judiciary will never go ahead. We're going to have to get the population to take the first step. We're going to have to get the population to understand what this is about. This is about genocide. This is about eugenics and genocide. Once they understand that, they're going to rise up. And that is then finally going to turn the tide in the courts of law as well. That's why I'm saying we can't rely on the courts of law. We can look at some of them, like, for example, the Indian courts of law. The Indian judicial system seems to be working. But other than that, it's up to us. We cannot sit back and wait for the courts of law to solve this. Each and every one of us has to do something, has to go out, talk to people, and educate the people. Try and expose everything that we know about, everything that we learn. In the Corona Committee, for example, or what you learn through your work, it has to be exposed. That's when people begin to listen. That's when they begin to ask questions. And that's the first step. And they cannot return. That's taking the red pill, so to speak.
Thank you very much, Rainer. I would like to address another question that was brought up by the audience. And I would like to give Kathryn the opportunity to answer it. The question is as follows. What advice would you give a 22-year-old man or woman about getting the COVID vaccine? Many are getting peer pressured and wanting to travel or get into restaurants and so on. It is hard for them to understand the depth of corruption. How would you deal with a friend, with an acquaintance, or with a relative who finds themselves in that situation?
So I would go to the Doctors for COVID Ethics website and to the resource section, and I would access both the student form and the family financial disclosure form. And I would walk through with them the informed consent, not just on the health issues, but also on the financial issues. Traditionally, in my experience, a vaccine injury can cost as much as $1 million to $5 million present value to a family. We've seen many instances where health insurance does not cover adverse events or death. Disability does not cover workman's compensation, will not be filed for and is disavowed in the United States. And so somebody with a vaccine injury not only finds themselves disabled and unable to work, but literally bankrupted, their family can be bankrupted. So the point of those forms is to help you understand both the health and the financial ramifications of adverse event and death and be prepared for it. And it's a very sobering experience because many people have not sat down and don't understand the things that have been presented to this week. I would just like to also answer, and this is something for young people to consider. If you look at the 20%, somebody on the panel said 20% of the people are sort of with us. If the 20% who are with us got up this morning and said, you know something, I'm going to stop building the prison that we're being put into. I'm going to stop banking with these banks. I'm going to stop investing my money in the stocks of the companies that are doing this. I'm going to turn off the media that's doing this. It's not that I'm not going to go protest, but I'm going to protest with my wallet and my money. We have a campaign at Solari called Cash Friday. Use cash on Friday, but if you absolutely refuse to support and build the digital control systems in the health area and in the money area, the financial area, 20% of the people in the world can turn this absolutely around, and they can do it in the 1 to 4 months that Mike Yaden described. So this is not hopeless. I agree with Sucharat. It's a small chance, but we have the power, that 20%, to completely lead a completely nonviolent revolution, and we do it in the digital systems, and we do it with our money, and we do it absolutely by changing what we do in our lives. So I would absolutely I would leave everybody with the message, you have much more power than you think, particularly in a highly leveraged financial system. And particularly, if you look at our problem, we don't have a healthcare problem. We don't have a financial problem. We have a governance problem. We have a planet that's being run by a secret governance system, and it's a small number of people. And if we refuse to comply and shift what we do in our own personal lives, they can't pull it off.
Thank you very much, Cassie. I would like to add another aspect of this question, right? One aspect is, how do you defend yourself if you already understood what the truth is? And the other question is, the other aspect is, how do you get people to understand the reality, the urgency of the situation? And this leads us back, I would think, to Patrick. What is the most effective way, you think? How could you, what kind of resources, what kind of strategies would you recommend to people who are sitting on the fence, who might be ready to consider alternative narratives to the official ones, but who are really not quite determined, not quite decided? How would you try to approach them? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really important aspect of it, Michael. I mean, we speak to a lot of people who came from the fence. Certainly, that's our target audience. We're not interested so much in preaching to the converted as we are to bringing people over that are questioning or reconsidering their position. That's the lion's share of our audience over the last year and a half. We meet them on the street. We speak to them. We engage with them at protests, rallies, most recently in London. And I think what's interesting is there's a major sea change in terms of the new media or independent media. And that is, there's a lot of professionals coming in, what you might call the middle class, the professional class, lawyers, people working for the pharmaceutical industry. We've met quite a few of them out on the street at some of these events. And so they have definitely changed their worldview, their viewpoint, or seen that this is important enough that they need to come out and they need to network and meet people who feel the same about these issues. The one thing that's been denied to people more than anything over the last year and a half has been human contact. People have been compartmentalized, have been isolated, have been denied contact and with their friends, family, their neighbors. Just generally, this has been a kind of systematic thing. So I think, you know, getting out of the virtual world and getting into the real world is really important right now. And no matter if lockdowns come or not, what country you're in, certainly that looks like it's going to be the case. The government's going in that direction in the UK for the fall and the winter. Almost certainly a new variant will magically appear and then the cases will rise and the lockdowns will come. I don't think it, less and less this is going to stop people from meeting, from connecting, from supporting each other, from sharing ideas. This is really, really important that we return back to basic principles of community. And that is happening. If anything, that vacuum is being filled right now. A lot of people are desiring to go into that, back into that, where we have accepted the digital existence for years and was promised that this would be the salvation or the utopia of the future with the advent of the internet. People are reconsidering this idea now more than ever. And I think, to me, that's very encouraging. And certainly that's a place to start.
Thank you very much. You brought one aspect which has already been addressed in this meeting, but I think for the sake of emphasis, it would be good to address it briefly again. So, Jared, maybe you can do it. The importance of the variants, how credible is the widely deployed narrative that variants force us into renewed lockdowns and to renewed top-up vaccinations and so on? Can you comment on this, please?
Yes. Well, Mike Eaton said very clearly what everyone in the field knows. These mutants are the next fake. They're so fake that it is difficult to understand that anyone can be lied to again. This is a civilized world. Most people in the Western world, and also everyone, has basic education. And they've been fooled and lied to so that they've lost their existence, lost their health, lost their lives. And they're willing to do this, to have this ordeal imposed upon them, this torment because of another lie, which is so, it's blatantly obvious that everything is a lie today. These mutants.
Seems to me that Jared is frozen up. Is that the general perception? Yeah. Okay. Then I guess we will have to abandon him for now. And Thomas.
Shall I continue for him, maybe?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Well, this is clear. This we learned also in medical studies. This is evolution, that the virus wants to spread. And to spread, a virus must become ever more contagious, while at the same time, ever less dangerous. Because, for example, if you take Ebola, where 50% of the infected die, this makes us so sick and even kills us that rapid that we cannot infect many people. So it is absolutely clear from an evolutionary standpoint and from common sense that these mutations are becoming ever less dangerous. If a virus once killed you after enough mutations, It makes you a sore throat, and then sometimes later nothing at all. It is the corona. The whole corona narrative is utter nonsense. From asymptomatic transmission who said, like, zero COVID. These mutants, killer mutants, are just another part of this crazy stuff. Yeah.
Crazy stuff, I think, sums it up very well. Yes, I agree with this assessment. Crazy stuff, I think, also applies to a lot of the mainstream media narratives that we are being fed this these days. Rainer, one aspect. The media, the mainstream media, do they not also make themselves culpable with spreading this gross sort of misinformation? Can they also be held liable?
Yes, we believe so. My friend, Professor Martin Schwab, who is the most important legal advisor of the resistance here in Germany, he has written an expert opinion on the media's culpability in this. He was trying to protect our friend, Dr. Wolfgang Wodak, because Wolfgang Wodak used to be a member of this anti-corruption NGO, Transparency International. They tried to kick him out because he gave interviews, they alleged, to the wrong people. And in trying to defend him, Martin Schwab looked at all the articles that have ever been written about Wolfgang Wodak, and it turns out that the only thing that they had to say when it came to his medical arguments is Nazi, Nazi, right wing, right wing. That's it. They don't have, you see, that's the problem that the other side has. They're using lots and lots of people who probably only have fragments of a brain. That makes them easy to control, but it's also difficult for them to actually engage in a real discussion with any of us. They can't do it. They just don't have, they can't do it. So to make a long story short, yes, we can hold them liable. That's why Martin wrote this expert opinion. It's 180 pages long. And I think since he's one of the smartest lawyers I know, there's a lot of substance to it. And it doesn't just apply to the German mainstream media. It applies to all of them, all of them.
Good, thank you. Catherine, do you have anything to add possibly to that question from a US perspective?
I would just add, I think it is so much easier for the lawyers and attorneys to get something accomplished if they have support in the court of popular opinion that is expressed both through the independent media, as Patrick described, but also as expressed through the money. So, if suddenly cash exploded as a result of Cash Friday, or we saw great movement of money out of the big New York Fed central banks that own the central bank and into much smaller banks and credit unions, that would make it much easier for the attorneys to go into court and go into court with in a manner that could protect the judges and start to get something done. So I think part of what we're seeing is, how do we help the attorneys and the lawyers and the people come together and with the independent media in a way that makes it really easy to start to bring the rule of law? So I would just say the more independent media and citizens can align to support the attorneys and the local officials who are willing to fight, the better the chance we have in the next 1 to 4 months to turn this around.
Patrick, do you want to comment from a UK perspective on this question?
Yeah, just to add to what Catherine's saying there, there's, you know, in stories we've covered, small businesses that have been targeted by local government running investigations if they're not wearing masks to the customers during lockdown, and levying incredible fines, tens of thousands of pounds, more than enough to bankrupt and some of these small to medium-sized businesses. We're talking about cafes, hairdressers, barbershops, people like this. So clearly the government's wanting to make an example of this, but it's the community coming to rally in their support that has allowed at least one of these that we know to mount hopefully a serious legal defense and to hire the best barristers, for instance, to work on their case. So, and that's really been by the community rallying to support, getting the word out through blogs, through social media, through Facebook groups, crowdfunding sites as well. So it's hard, it's tedious work. It might not seem like a lot to some people, but the symbolism of David and Goliath narrative is powerful. So, you know, a few small victories, certainly you can't win a war without a lot of small victories. So that's definitely going to happen at the local level. So, and I think that's as significant as anything.
Another question, maybe also for Patrick, because it relates to the UK. It's not related to the media, but we have viewers asking how they can get hold of COVID therapeutics if they are in the UK, for example. And I guess it pertains to ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. Do we have insight into that?
We've had some, certainly Sam White and some of the other doctors have commented on that. You can get some therapeutics, specifically ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. I don't know if it's as extreme a situation where you have in the U.S. where the pharmacists are at war with the general practitioners. In other words, they won't fulfill that prescription if it's ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, for instance. So I don't know if it's that serious, but certainly there's out of licensed drugs that people are buying or getting shipped to them internationally, maybe at a premium cost. So, you know, maybe it's a case of lobbying for these issues. I mean, this might become a big issue for people, that people need to lobby the NHS or the local health authority, or perhaps take the matter to court or put pressure on the regulators to, you know, loosen up regulation on these sort of things. Clearly, there's a targeting of cheap and effective therapeutics. You talked about remdesivir previously, and I think it's dexamethasone, and all of these high cost R&D drugs. This is in the U.S. This is what the NIH does: is it funnels money to research and development for things that are going to pay off for those companies in the end, and certainly open source drugs like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine aren't going to be anything that anyone's interested in doing any serious studies on, because there's not a big payoff at the end. So that's just speaking to the general corruption of the industry and how tightly wound they are with government institutions, public health institutions. But in terms of the UK, the NHS has effectively largely a monopoly on that process. So it's really going to take a big amount of public effort and campaigning to get movement on that, I would think.
Great, thank you. I just have received a tip from behind the scenes that in the UK, the Bird Group apparently also can help with procuring such drugs. Now we are about 10 minutes from the end of this round. After that, Charles will have his final word. So can I have from each of you, maybe except Sucharit, because he is going to get his the overall closing speech, can I have some final thoughts from the four of you? Kerstin, maybe starting with you.
A year ago, the Salira Report took up a crowdfund, started a crowdfund called the Take Action Crowdfund. And it was inspired, if you come and you see it, it will send you to support the attorneys, litigators who are taking action. You'll see Reiner's German Corona Investigation Committee there, but you'll see many others, as well as independent media that's supporting them. And we encourage everybody to go in and do that directly, not through us. And you'll see a quote at the top. The thing that inspired the Take Action Crowdfund was I had a former client who called me. She was selling a piece of real estate. It was a large piece of real estate, and she wanted to know where she should reinvest the money. And I told her, I said, what is it about what Klaus Schwab is saying that you don't understand about it's 2030 and you will have no assets? I said, if you don't have an army to protect your assets, there's no point in buying more assets. You need an army. And what I would say to you is in every town, in every county, in every country around the world, there are people willing to fight. You're watching. You've been watching a lot of wonderful people on this symposium, but there are people everywhere. And now is the time for you. There's no way to protect your assets against this. You know, the only way you can protect your assets is to fight. And as Mike Yaden said, we have a very short time or interval. And whatever way you can, whether it's your assets, your time, your attention, your money, I would suggest you spend it on an army and you get your army moving right now, because that is what to turn the tide. And if we don't turn the tide now, I assure you, in 2030, Klaus Schwab is probably right. You will have no assets.
Thank you. Rainer, can I continue with you, please?
Sure. I believe it's that there's two things that are even more important than the legal efforts that we're all engaging in, our international group of colleagues. One is we have to take back our sovereignty, each and every one of us. We have to sort of go back to the roots, regionalize. This is what's happening in Germany right now, because there's been this flood in parts of Western Germany, and it turns out the government wasn't there. The institutions completely failed. It was only private people. It was the farmers who left the crops out in the field to go out and help. And it was private contractors who came out and pushed away the rubble, saved lives. It is so important to disconnect from these global corporations and global NGOs by forming our own little community, reforming our own little communities, set up our own tailor-made set of rules for each and every one of these little regions and communities. Then we can connect with each other, but we have to disconnect from these global corporations, these evil global corporations and NGOs. The other thing is we have to act in a human way, in a non-aggressive way. We have to, even though I sometimes get really mad, but then I go down in my fitness room. What we really should do is, even when we think that there's someone from the other side, not really the other side, but some of the people who have fallen victim to this mass hypnosis, we shouldn't be aggressive. Here's a little story. It's a quick story to tell, which was told to us by Dr. Sarnas, who is a former, now retired surgeon from formerly East Germany. And he told us this story about how he tried to get some money from an ATM. He walked into a bank, into the lobby of the bank, and there was this woman who was wearing a mask, and he wasn't wearing a mask. She was an older woman, and she kind of shied away from him and said, "No, you can't do this. You're going to have to wear a mask." He said, "No, I don't have to wear a mask. And by the way, you don't either." "Yes, I do, because I don't want to get infected, and then I'm going to infect my husband, and he's old, much older than I am." And he said, "You don't have to wear a mask." And he walked up to her, pulled away her mask, and took her in his arms, hugged her. And she started to cry, told him nobody had taken her in his arms for a year and a half. I think that's the most important thing. We have to act like humans.
Thank you very much. Patrick, can you give us 2 minutes of your final thoughts?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you, Michael. The biggest challenge that's facing society right now is there's definitely a threat that's being posed, dividing society. The division that we're seeing with the issue of vaccines, for instance, this is not just dividing society or communities, it's dividing families, it's literally spouses, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters. People saying, "Oh, we can't go to the family reunion because, well, such and such isn't vaccinated, so we're not going to meet this year as a family." These are real things that I have personal experience with. and it affecting a lot of different people. And I think that's probably one of the most regrettable and perhaps the most insidious aspect of this, the vaccination issue, is that it can do that in ways that so few issues have ever in history been able to put a wedge right between actual families within the same households, for instance. So, and this is going on, of course, in schools, in companies, in workplaces with colleagues. So that to me is one of the most worrying and dangerous things that I've witnessed, especially in the last few months. Very divisive. So I think what's the solution to this? If you're able to, and like our previous speaker, someone said that these things don't persist forever, that at some point logic emerges and the illusion falls by the wayside. Certainly the fundamental pillars of the whole pandemic, one of them is the myth of the asymptomatic spread. This has been debunked by multiple peer-reviewed scientific papers, at least five or six widely cited ones that we know of, and also the PCR test, which the PCR test, by the way, is driving the variant hysteria as well. They're not fully genomically sequencing all of these so-called variants. A lot of this work is done biosurveillance with PCRs as shortcuts. So if you dismantle the narrative, remove the fundamental pillars of this illusion, I think a lot of people who do have a cognitive faculty left after all of this gaslighting will be able to see that. Certainly we found that with the asymptomatic spread. A lot of parents have looked at that, and it's caused them to recalculate their position with regards to their children and schools and so forth. So that's very encouraging. So you got to get to the fundamental arguments. What are the pillars holding up the arguments that are holding up the facade of the global pandemic? You remove those pillars and you find a lot of people will see the light at that point. Certainly that's one of the things that we're trying hard to do in the independent media and with our work at the UK column, 21st Century Wires.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thomas, just brief short statement. Thank you.
As I already had my call to intervention to doctors, I like to mention another very important thing, what Rainer brought up. 2,000 years ago, humanity knew that there was good and bad, or even evil. And nowadays, this has already disappeared. So the notion is now, well, everybody can be between angel and devil. This is totally wrong. It's very important that we restart a debate about good, bad, and evil, not on the childish level of I am the good, you are the bad guy, or on Kant's knowledge, but on the knowledge of Robert D. Hare, a Canadian psychiatrist who in the 60s studied mass murders in prisons. And the term it is about is psychopathy. So there are about 2% we can discuss about this figure, because this, of course, is a continuum. But about 2% of the people have no empathy, no remorse, nothing at all. So if it's in their interest, they can kill anybody, 6 people, 6,000 people, 6 million people without twinkling an eye, if they profit from it and if they are need not be afraid to be prosecuted. And this is really important, because most people, about 98%, are empathetic people who cannot even imagine that evil people, really evil people, do exist. And therefore they have not the imagination to realize what is going on here. And I really suggest that we have also this debate, because it helps us to understand the world. If we do not understand that on this planet live about 98% mice, and amongst us 2% cats, or if you prefer, 98% sheep and 2% wolves, and the most dangerous of them, of course, the wolves in sheep clothing, then we cannot understand what is happening in the world, and also not the whole humanist history. This was from Adam, Eve, and the snakes to nowadays. They always were the powerful, and they controlled us. And nowadays, while there is the internet that is probably was meant to control us, we can turn the weapon against them. And we, for the first time in human history, we have the possibility to really connect, because we are 98%. And if we connect, they have no chance at all. And it is important that, in my point of view, really, that there is a decisive, this is a kind of final battle of, I mean, you can call me insane again, but it's in a way, it is the final battle of evil versus good. And we must realize this and stand up and fight. And if not for ourselves, then for the future of our children and of our grandchildren. I mean, in what dystopic world should they live? I mean, this is our responsibility. We all here have some age. We had all a good life after war, when things were always getting better. But now I think we must realize that we are in the world. We are in the Third World War since years, 4 years now. And in the atomic age, of course, this cannot be led by atomic weapons, but this is a psychological war, a psychological operation of these, of only part of these 2% against the empathetic humanity. This is, they of course want to transform us into either psychopaths or transhumans. Yeah. Sorry, okay. Sometimes I read too much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Before I hand this over to Sucharit for his closing out of the entire conference, I would just briefly say it was a great pleasure to have this round table with you. Very enjoyable, very informative. I would also like to thank personally the UK column for hosting this great conference. It was a wonderful event. And with that, I would like to say goodbye to all of you, and we will just simply leave it with Sucharit to close out this conference. Thank you very much. Goodbye.